All right, hey everybody. It's good to see you again. I got back from vacation on Saturday and Sunday was my first day back at work. So you may have noticed that on Sunday I started reading the form again. So I'm back. And I did do the contemplations all week. I just didn't read the form all week. In fact, I was in Yellowstone, and in Yellowstone I don't even have access to internet or cell service at all there. So it was impossible for me to get on the internet. But I did keep up with the quotes, even though I didn't keep up with the form. So I'm fully prepared for tonight. But first, I have something from Michael Langford. This is a song along with his brief commentary on this song. So let me share the song first. And then we'll look at the commentary. The lyrics are here, so you'll be able to look at the lyrics and really pay attention to the song, and then you'll understand the commentary a little better.
Let me on the ground and fly me in the sky. Show me where to look, tell me.
Yeah, it looked like I could only see Don and Shauna, but it looked like they really got into that. So now let me read to you Michael's commentary on that. He says, if a student of these teachings sang this song to me, this is what I would say. Give me a word. That's a quote from the song. His response, I have given you thousands of words. Give me a sign. That's a quote from the song. His response, I have given you thousands of signs. Show me where to look. That's a quote from the song. His response, I have shown you where to look. Look at your own awareness. Look at the seer. Tell me what I will find. That's a quote from the song. His response, I have told you what you will find hundreds of times. You will find infinite, eternal awareness, love, bliss. Oh heaven, let your light shine down. That's a quote from the song. His response, you are the light. Your true self is the light. Tell me love will be there. That's a quote from the song. His response, I have told you love will be there hundreds of times. You are love. Your true self is love. So that's from Michael. All right, so do any of you have anything that you would like to share before I begin with my collection? Yes, Ron.
You know, one of the things that kind of strikes me a little bit is that so much of what is said by these masters has to do with destroying the mind, getting rid of the mind, and you kind of contrast a little bit against Bernadette Roberts, who actually sees value in the ego and the mind, making kind of your ego your amigo, because as long as the mind's bending on itself, that's really what we are. Any kind of experience we have is still mind, regardless. And yes, you have that. You know, that center in the middle of that dot in the middle of the of whatever example she particularly uses that can be accessed and seen from time to time. But she doesn't really talk about destroying the mind. I'm just curious about anybody's thoughts about that.
Yes, George, go ahead.
You know, I really feel a sense that there's nothing wrong with the mind. For whatever reason, we're having this experience of being separate, and yet I don't think that spirit is judging us as this is better or worse. It just is. And so I don't know what the purpose is, but I don't feel guilty for being George. So that's it.
Yeah, and I was going to say, Bernadette Roberts does not use the term destroying the mind, but she does refer to the second awakening as, she doesn't use this language. She uses the symbol of these circles, right? And like when you're an egoic person, for lack of better words, you guys know what I mean by that. When you're an egoic person, which is what I covered the other night, there's just a pinhole in the middle. You know, you have like a little bit of access to the divine through that pinhole. And then when the ego dies, it's like a fist went through that piece of, paper consciousness. And there's this huge hole in the middle through which you access the divine. But when you awaken to the absolute, the entire sheet of paper is gone. So that entire sheet of paper, again, is consciousness. So that entire sheet of paper being gone could be the same as what the Eastern masters mean when they say destroy the mind. right? So, because mind and consciousness can be used synonymously. So, yeah, go ahead, Ron.
Just as a follow-up, it strikes me that destroy the mind, that's almost a mental command. You know, engaging the mind to engage, or, you know, you had an engagement. And where Bernadette Roberts is, you're living it out in the marketplace, makes that hole bigger and bigger and bigger, and it just falls away.
Yeah, and you know, I think
at the end, so that's, yeah.
Yeah, I think that destroy the mind is kind of cultural, you know, that's the way I take it in the East. But the way that at least the way my mind, hopefully my right mind, interprets it is destroy the mind to me means put attention and effort into awareness and away from mind, right? You might even call it starve the mind, right? As I'm putting attention into awareness and not in mind, you know, so I don't know, to me that's what they mean by destroy the mind. But I understand that destroy is kind of an aggressive language, and I also understand that some people could interpret it as engage the mind and try to kill the mind. And I don't think that would ever work, my humble opinion. I think that's giving the mind too much attention. Anything else? All right, then. Let's see what I have collected. So, I guess I wrote down, I thought this was related to Michael Langford's Shine email, so I went back and added quote 709. Let's look at what 709 says and see how I thought it was related to his Shine email. Shine was the email I just read to you. Oh, yeah, 709 simply says, you are the self, not the mind. And of course, he emphasized that a couple of times in that little email, right? He says, you are love. Your true self is love, right? He was emphasizing that you are that self. So that's why quote 709 reminded me of his email. Let's go on to 710. The goblin mind residing in the body has nothing to do with the self, yet it quietly assumes, I am the self. This is the cause of birth and death. This assumption robs you of courage. So I think I was just curious if anybody contemplated that last part. This assumption robs you of courage, this assumption that the mind is the self. And if you did contemplate it, what you came up with? Shauna.
I forget exactly what I wrote, but if you assume that you are this body, mind, the self, you're in fear. Its main characteristic is fear. So it robs you of natural courage that you have when you're true self. That's how I contemplated it.
Thank you. Does anyone else have something they want to share on that line? Yes, Ron.
Yeah, for me, it was, I sat with this for a little while. What my contemplation was that, you know, the path that, at least for me, that I'm on, and maybe many of you may feel the same, is a very unconventional path. It definitely is outside the norm of what you see life here on Earth, or most people perceive it to be. And the more I'm engaged in mind, the more I'm kind of drawn away from the unconventional. It's kind of like a magnet pulling me away from the unconventional path. Where the the more I focus on awareness versus the mind, I just find that my courage is stronger.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Yeah. And I think fearlessness and courage, you know, could be seen as the same. I also have found on this path that it takes courage sometimes to follow guidance, depending on what your guidance is, because the guidance goes against your conditioning, your upbringing, your beliefs. And to the degree that you believe that you are a person in a world, you will ignore that guidance that requires courage. To the degree that you trust that you are beyond the world and that the guidance is helping you to realize that, you'll be able to have the courage to follow that guidance. So that's what it kind of reminded me of. And I've had several experiences in my life where if I had put the personhood above the desire to learn the truth is not real, that the world is not real, I would not have followed the guidance. So the personhood had to be less important than the desire to learn that the world was not real, which is the same as saying to learn that the truth is true. But for me, I went through this phase where I had to learn that the world wasn't real. And that took courage. Let's see what else we have here. 7:13. Oh, I guess I want to say one more thing about the courage before I move on. I know I started by saying fearlessness and courage could be seen to be the same. But what I also want to point out is when I had this different guidance, like when I had the guide of my job, even some days writing in TI, some of the situations that I went through with Laurent, like the time I was guided to give him the checkbook and not look anymore, there was a lot of fear, and that's why it took courage. So it wasn't fearlessness, right? There was a lot of fear, and that's why it took courage. I guess that was the point I wanted to make. And again, I had to want to learn that the world is not real or learn that the truth is true more than I wanted to cling to the safety of my person. All right, so 7:13, he who is polluted by the ego sense, whether he is a learned scholar or one superior even to that, he indeed is a wicked man. So I wanted to know what came in your contemplation of this last portion, he is a wicked man. Yes, George.
You know, I grouped those together, but to me, it's about pride and that selfishness of looking at it from the perspective of the individual. So wicked seems to be a pretty strong term. But until we get over that sense of personhood, it involves a lot of selfishness. It's all about me.
Yeah, thank you. And I even came along across another quote, but again, I do three sets of quotes every day, so I get very confused as to which quotes, but I came across a quote that had this long list of things like greed, and I can't even remember the others, but it was all stuff that came from selfishness, exactly what you're talking about, from caring about me and mine more than anything else. And in fact, you know, one of the things we saw in the movie Next, those of you that have already watched it, in the movie Next, at the near end of the movie, Los Angeles is destroyed because I can't remember his name, Chris, was selfish because he cared about him and his girlfriend, right? That's all he cared about, him and his girlfriend. And as a result of that, you know, me and mine, right? And as a result of that, the all of Los Angeles was destroyed. So, that selfishness and wickedness are very similar. But I thought I would also look up the word wicked in the dictionary. So let me do that. It says evil or morally wrong, but what I want to look at, let's see, what was I saw something when I looked it up. Maybe I was looking at a different dictionary. I don't remember what I saw.
No, but you may have seen a couple things I did, the same thing, Regina.
What did you see?
This is Ron. Wicked can also, a synonym for wicked is also miserable and capable of harm.
Yeah. So oh, that was it.
In my contemplation, I said, yeah, seemingly harming yourself, you know, oneself. Yeah. And yeah, you're definitely not at peace.
Yeah, that was it, the capable. I must have looked in a different dictionary because it's not. Oh, no, it is. I just looked in the wrong place. Sure enough, it says intended to or capable of harming someone or something. That was exactly it, Ron. Thank you. Intended to or capable of harming someone or something. And you know, what we learned in the code, remember, was that as we focus on egoic thoughts in our mind, you know, again, I could just be hating my neighbor for, you know, for being too loud right now while I'm trying to teach, or, you know, something, breaking my lawnmower when he borrowed it, or whatever. And I'm walking around hating him, but that hate energy is going into the world and creating other scripted scenes. You know, like there was a man this week, what came forth this week, I think he did it 6 weeks ago, who killed his wife and what was it, 4 or 5 children? You know, like these scenes come forward from all of our egos. So we are much more capable of causing harm. It's not intended, right? And that's what's really interesting about the dictionary definition, is that it says intended or capable of, right? And what we don't remember is that our focus on the ego in our own minds is sending this pollution, as Michael Singer calls it, out into the environment, and it's creating these scripts. So although wicked seems like a really strong word, I think that it's in our benefit to accept that as true, because not with guilt, you know, not with guilt, but with insight. Because if we realize how much harm listening to the ego causes, we might be more motivated to let it go. I remember in Jan Fraser's first book, she talked about how once her ego fell away, how she was surprised to become aware of how harmful an ego was, even in a well-intentioned spiritual person like her. Right? I mean, the ego is just naturally harmful. And if capable of harm is one of the definitions of wicked, then it's fair to say that the ego is wicked. And again, without guilt, without judgment, just with insight as a motivating factor. Any other comments? All right, then let's look what I had next. I had number 714. This creation is no doubt born of ignorance, and the belief in creation destroys true perception. Though this creation is unreal, yet on account of the emergence of the ego sense, it appears to be solidly real. So let me share my screen again. And what I want to do is go show you where I took this with the RDA journal, or at least show you a portion of it. I'm not going to waste our time with all of it. Step three. Okay, so something is not healed in me. Now, what's interesting to me when I looked at this was the date, February 14, 2013. Because by the end of March 2013, this was healed in me. So it's kind of interesting. When I look at this now, I realize this was the beginning of the end. Something is not healed in me. It is my perception of the worst of the worst, extreme suffering, and unacceptable conditions. These, I feel, I do not want to be real. And this feeling comes from the fear that they are. It comes from the fear that the illusion of a spiritual reality stops here, where the absolute reality of suffering is too real to be denied. So again, if we look at this quote, we might be able to see how this started bringing this up for me. It says, though the creation is unreal, yet on account of the emergence of the ego sense, it appears to be solidly real. And when I contemplated that, I started seeing that I thought suffering was more real than the truth. In fact, notice I call it an illusion of a spiritual reality, right? Like the spirituality that we seek and focus on is the illusion, and we want it to be true just because we don't want suffering to be true. But in reality, suffering is real, and if you suffer enough, by God, you can't deny it. That was kind of my belief. And what happened after this, there's a few things that happened. One of them was I went to Israel in March of 2013. This is when we did the Jesus Trail. And I went to Israel, and we came across a calf that had been abandoned by its mother because it was dying. And, you know, some of us gathered around this calf, and it was a very, very hot day, and we gave it some water, and we tried to find out who the owner was, see if we could get it to a veterinarian. Here we are in a foreign country trying to find out who owns this property, and, you know, we weren't successful at all. And in the end, and I don't know how long we stayed with this calf, an hour and a half, but in the end, we had to just walk away. But what I noticed about me in that experience was the calf was secretly inside, I was praying for it to die because I didn't want it to suffer. To me, suffering was the worst of the worst. And this poor thing was laying there suffering, and I just wanted it to die. So I noticed that in me, that I thought death was better than suffering. But then what happened when I got home from Israel was I got very, very sick. In fact, I think it's the most physical pain I've ever felt. And I even remember at one point I cried out. I had a picture of Jesus on the wall. I cried out to Jesus and said, you know, just please help me. And I was very lucky because Danielle came home then. She still lived with me at that point. And she came home, and she's a nurse. And I told her, I said, Danielle, I'm suffering. And she called up a nurse practitioner friend of hers and was able to get a diagnosis over the phone and able to go get me some drugs. And that did help the worst of the worst. But I was still sick for 3 days after that. But at least when I got past the horrible, horrible pain, I was able to contemplate my situation a little better. And when I contemplated my situation, I knew that my suffering was coming from a belief. I knew that had to be true. I had enough faith in these teachings. But I also knew that I shouldn't go looking for that belief. I knew that I had to do nothing. And that was it. Just do, I had to do nothing. I had to, you could say, stay out of it. I don't know how else to say that. I had to do nothing. Like the Course says, I need do nothing. I had to do nothing. And one of the things I ended up doing in that 3 days was I watched the movie Lonesome Dove. And in the movie Lonesome Dove, this woman gets kidnapped by the Indians, and what they do to her is really horrible. So I'm watching that suffering too. So I've got my own suffering going on, the suffering of the calf, the suffering in the movie. And all of a sudden, I mean, it happened all by itself. I realized, and apparently I already knew it because I wrote it here a month earlier, I realized that the belief that was causing my suffering was the belief that suffering is more real than truth. I realized that is a belief. And you know, what you believe you're going to experience. Think about that. What you believe you're going to experience. So if I believe suffering is more real than truth, guess how strong that suffering is going to be and how it's going to pull me away from being able to contemplate or meditate or have any willingness at all. You know, when I suffer, that appeared to be the most real thing in the world. But that appearance came from the belief. And so when this belief arose in my mind and I realized what was going on, I gave my willingness to let go of it. And I can't say exactly when it died, because it wasn't like this pow moment. It kind of died in secret in the background. But since then, as you guys probably know, I've had other opportunities to suffer. Like when I broke my wrist, you know, really kind of squished my wrist, train wrecked it in a skiing accident. When I got thrown from a horse that was galloping and my whole body was in pain. But I've never suffered since that day. I felt pain. I felt intense pain, but I've never suffered, which is absolutely amazing to me. You know, because until this was my experience, when people said, you know, pain is what is it? Pain is required, but suffering is optional, or however they say it. I used to think that didn't make any sense, because pain is suffering, dang it. But it's not true. And I know that for a fact now. You can experience intense pain and not suffer at all. What causes the suffering, or at least in my case, was the belief that suffering was the most real thing of all. Right? So that's what this quote at least initiated for me. And again, it took a month and a half at least before it was completed. But though the creation is unreal, yet on account of the emergence of the ego sense, it appears solidly real. So what we want to remember is what appears solidly real, no matter what it is coming from our, you guys can't see me as well if I turn that on, is coming from our belief. The belief is the cause. The belief is the cause. The belief is the cause. So whatever appears solidly real and is causing you pain in your life, be willing to see the belief. Because when you're free of the belief, that's it. Pain is inevitable. Suffering is optional. When you're free of that belief, you'll also be free of the experience. So, any comments on that before I move forward? You can tell the days are getting shorter, because this is the first time since I've been in this new house that I've been tempted to turn on a light. I'm having a little bit of trouble seeing from the window, but we'll see if I can make it for the next 20 minutes, since you guys can't see me if I turn on the light. Let's look at number 715. The cause of this world appearance and bondage is indeed the mind. And you can see how that might be true based on the story that I just told you. The cause of suffering was based on the belief that suffering was real in the mind. So if that's true, then this also could be true. Although, to be honest, I can't validate that for you, because I still experience the world, right? But it kind of makes sense that if this smaller story could be true, which I know is true, that this bigger story could also be true. The cause of this world appearance and bondage is indeed in the mind. All right, so I have here, let's look at the RDA journal. So let me share my screen. Let's go to 7:15. Do not allow the apparent severity of an appearance distract from the cause of the appearance. Whatever you look upon, remember it comes from the mind. Look at the mind, see the culprit idea, and then look beyond the idea to that which is not affected. So again, this is all before I actually let go of that belief in suffering, but it's kind of interesting to look back at the journal historically now, and you can see I was being prepared to do that. But do not allow the apparent, listen to these words, severity of an appearance. This is even before I had that severe illness, right? Do not allow the apparent severity of an appearance distract from the cause of the appearance. Whatever you look upon, remember it comes from the mind. And that's even true of this man who killed his wife and four or five kids, whatever it was. I think it was four kids, his wife and four kids. You know, that appearance, that script, those thoughts that went into that man's mind that he believed that led him to commit that crime comes from, again, the mind of all of us, right? Do not allow the apparent severity of an appearance distract from the cause of the appearance. Whatever you look upon, remember it comes from the mind. Look at the mind, see the culprit idea. And then what I wanted to highlight in this particular journal entry was, then look beyond the idea to that which is not affected. Right, that's kind of the completion of that loop. You don't just look at the idea and stop. Lots of people do that with root cause inquiry. They look at an idea like the I am bad belief and they just stop there. But you want to go on to the next step, which is to look beyond that belief to that which is real, that which is not affected, right? Look at the false and then look at the real. And through contrast of looking at both of them, you learn which one is enduringly real and which one is false. And then I had, in relation to this, to go ahead and read 7:16 from the seven steps. So 7:16, the best method is by inquiring to the nature of the self, which is infinite. So this is that follow through, right? You look at the false, and then you look at the real, and this is explaining the best method. The best method is by inquiring into the nature of the self, which is infinite. Your mind will be completely absorbed. Then both the mind and the inquiry will cease. Remain firmly established in what remains after that. So again, whatever you see, do not be distracted by its severity. It comes from the mind. When you see the culprit idea, recognize that is the cause of the appearance, but then follow through by looking at that which is not affected. Again, the best method is by inquiring into the nature of the self. Any questions? It's funny how it's getting completely dark in here, but because of the light of the computer screen, you guys can see me fine, even though I'm sitting in a dark room. And if I turn on the light, you can't see me anymore. If I turn on the overhead lights, you can see me. If it gets too dark, I'll get up and turn them on. The next thing I had to look at was 7:17. Says, the supreme consciousness alone exists. It is the supreme truth, untainted by any impurity, forever in a state of perfect equilibrium and devoid of ego sense. Once this truth is realized, it shines constantly without setting. So it's not like my sun out here, which is rapidly setting. It shines constantly without setting. But I have in my notes that I wanted to go look at RDA Journal for 717. So let me share. Hopefully it was just 717A. Let me look at my notes again real quick. Let's see, you guys are in my way. Move you. Yeah, 717A. There is a fundamental confusion between what is real and what is unreal. This fundamental confusion itself keeps the unreal seeming real. Therefore, the answer to all problems and the clarity that ends all suffering is seen beyond this one confusion. And what's interesting here is the date. This is now March 25th. My guess is this is after the illness. So this is probably when I'm getting back to my journal after the illness. But again, there's a fundamental confusion between what is real and what is unreal. The fundamental confusion itself keeps the unreal seeming real. Therefore, the answer to all problems and the clarity that ends all suffering is seen beyond this one confusion. And again, that's what the contrast does, that these quotes seem to be bringing forth, at least for me this week. You know, the quotes are saying, whatever you see, it comes from the mind. No matter how severe it is, it comes from the mind, right? The Amazon forest burning comes from the mind. Alaska melting comes from the mind, right? No matter how severe it is, it comes from the mind. When you see the belief, and of course the primary belief is what? Anybody can unmic themselves and answer that. What's the primary belief? If you're typing it, I can't see your typing. Then let me stop sharing, then maybe then I can see your typing.
Is it the belief in I am a person?
Yeah. Or John wrote separation. That's the same thing, right? The primary belief that causes all of this is the I thought, the I am a person, the separation. That's all the same thing, right? So what happens then is you look at that belief, I am a person. You can even look at I think I am the one suffering. I am the one that's upset about the heating up of the world. I am whatever. I'm upset about this sick animal, you know, that I can't help. And then after you look at that, the I am the person belief, then you look at the unaffected. You go beyond it right then. And through the contrast of looking at the false and the true, over and over and over again, you realize which is true and which is passing, which is temporary, which is untrue. So that one, clearing up that one confusion, the confusion about what's true and what's false, is the answer to all suffering. To me, that was a major theme. Only now I can't hardly see my book at all. So one moment while I turn on my overhead lights, we are now in a even though it looks like it's still light outside when I put the computer down, but it's too dark in here to see. There. Now maybe I can see my book and stuff. Just kind of important. So again, that contrast of looking back and forth between the false and the real, that's what helps us to realize what is true, right? Takes us beyond that one confusion. And again, as I was mentioning, that's what a lot of these quotes this week keep pointing at, that practice of recognizing the appearance comes from the mind, accepting that the appearance comes from the mind or from the ego sense, and then looking to the true over and over and over again. But of course, where we often fail, if you guys can accept that lightly, is even at that first step, we look at the appearance and we believe the appearance, right? And we get upset about the appearance. So it's looking at the appearance and realizing it comes from the mind or the ego sense. They're really the same. And accepting that. And then looking at the unaffected. Seven, 18. I am pure consciousness, devoid of ego sense, and all pervading. There is neither birth nor death for this consciousness. That's always interesting for me when I read that. There is neither birth nor death for this consciousness, because when I look at the unaffected awareness in myself, I can see that it's present. I cannot see that it doesn't have birth or death. How about you guys? What's your experience with it? Shawna, you want to go ahead and share?
For me, that it feels like there's no beginning or end. So that would be the same as life or death.
Yeah, no birth or death. Well, the way that I see that it has no birth or no death isn't actually by looking in my case, because I can see it's here now. And I guess you would have to enter thinking to think about birth and death. But I mean, I can't validate that. Maybe someone else can, but I can't. But where I can validate that is, believe it or not, when I look out. When I look out, I can see that life awareness everywhere and ongoing. I can see forms being born, and I can see forms dying, and I can see that life awareness never changes. I can see that forms come and go, and life awareness remains exactly the same. Does anybody have anything they want to share about their contemplation of there is neither birth nor death for this consciousness? All right, let's go on to, go ahead, Ron. Thank you. Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't describe it as a feeling. I'm not sure how I do. Maybe it's just a deep understood truth, a knowing, and it's something that took a while to kind of take root, and just kind of putting a bunch of different, you know, pieces together. You know, I'm well aware of all the different near-death experiences that people have had. So it's clear that when the body is dead, there's no brain activity. Wherever the doctor in North Carolina was, they had no brain activity at all for 5 days, but yet had an experience that there's something there that survives the body. And in just deep contemplation, particularly with Nisargadatta, that beingness is just, it's, I don't know. I don't know how to describe it, but it came from a progression of different ratifications of things I couldn't ignore, and things that came to me. So I have to say it started intellectually and then moved to be more organic, but I don't know that I can describe it as a feeling.
Well, and you know, it's interesting because I think in your own way, it kind of happened for you the same way it happened for me, was by looking out rather than looking in. Because like you talked about near-death experiences and contemplating them, right? It was kind of through the looking out that I came to that same sense rather than the looking in.
there was a little bit of looking in just with Nisargadatta and contemplating and actually kind of rewinding the tape, you know, from when I first perceived I was the I am, and then just trying to, you know, yes. You know, but who knows, maybe I'm psychologically, manufacturing it. I don't know, but whatever it was, it ended up being a very deep rooted belief and I call it, just at least for myself, a knowing.
Yeah. And that's kind of why I wanted to have this discussion too, because I think it's a mistake for us just to read what a master writes and accept it as true. Like, I think in one way or another, we need to contemplate it. We need to verify it for ourselves, right? Whether it's going in until some kind of a realization hits, or whether it's contemplating what we see without until some kind of a realization hits. I think it's an error if we just go, okay, there's no birth, there's no death. You know, I read that in a book and I believe it, right? It needs to be deeper. Like you said, it needs to take root. So there needs to be a very serious contemplation in one way or the other. So thank you for sharing how that worked for you. Does anyone else have anything to share on that point? Yes, George.
Okay. I wrote, I am pure consciousness. Okay, I recognize that there's consciousness, awareness. And then I wrote, I am not George. I have an ego sense of a thought of George. The George thought can and will vanish like the morning mist. Okay, so, you know, I can write that, and I don't believe that, you know. I have a sense of George. I have a sense of consciousness, but I also have a sense of George. And so I don't know.
Can I ask you a question, George? What about when you were writing it? What about in the moment when you were writing it? Did you have a stronger sense of the eternal nature in that moment?
Right. I had a sense, I am consciousness.
Yes.
So
thank you. I think that's the value of contemplation. I think that when we are in contemplation of these quotes, we get those tastes. It may fade later in the day. George comes back, Tony comes back, right, et cetera, et cetera. But when we're in the contemplation of these quotes, we taste it, we smell it, we feel it. Like when we're writing that, right, we're kind of marinating in that. And I think that's helpful. That's the contemplation that we need to do rather than just the blind believing. I know I write lots of things when I'm contemplating that are very true for me when I write them. And later I may read them and in that moment they're not true. But they were true when I wrote them. I wouldn't just make it up crap and writing it down. You know, that's the value of contemplation, right? Yeah. Yeah. And doing it day by day by day, maybe occasionally not doing it, you know, because you go to Yellowstone or whatever. But for the most part, doing it day by day by day, I think it has an incredible effect. Takes root, as Ron said. So that is the end of our class for tonight. I have a note here to read 7:21 at the conclusion of class just to close this up. So let's look at 7:21. The utter destruction or extinction of the mind is the extinction of the creation cycle. It is also known as the abandonment of mind. Therefore, uproot this tree whose seed is the I idea, with all its branches, fruits, and leaves, and rest in the space of the heart. Now that's interesting, because when I picked this quote out to close class with, I didn't know Ron was going to start class by talking about, you know, destroy the mind. But the reason that I picked this, again, this is using strong words like utter destruction, extinction of the mind. But then in the very same quote, it says, it is also known as the abandonment of the mind, which we know means shifting our intention, right? Shifting our attention away from the mind. And then it also tells us in the same quote and rest in the space of the heart. So again, this tells us exactly how to, quote, destroy the mind. Just remove your attention and focus on the heart instead. And that is the end for today. And enjoy your next week of contemplation. And I'll see you guys next Tuesday night. Thanks.